This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. This is Inspired, a series where an artist invites someone who's influenced their creative practice to share stories behind their connection, their inspiration, and everything in between. I'm Rebecca Alero. I'm a sound artist, composer, and researcher, and I studied performance and creative enterprise at Guildhall School of Music and Drama. In this episode, I'm speaking to Elaine Michener, a contemporary vocalist, movement artist, and composer. Elaine has performed and collaborated with numerous leading artists, including Warmother, Mark Padmore, George E. Lewis, The Otolith Group, Apartment House, David Toop, and many, many more. She is also the founder of the collective called The Rolling Calf with Jason Yard and Neil Charles. Her sound works are also held in a curated collection by George E. Lewis at the Darmstadt Festival. I invited Elaine to talk about her work because I'm really interested in the way she uses the voice, which is something I'm starting to ease into my own practice, and how using the body as an instrument, such as the voice, can really deeply access a certain narrative. But I also know that Elaine has worked with Julius Eastman's compositions. And if you're not familiar with Julius Eastman, he is a Black contemporary classical composer whose work may fit into the category of minimalism and certainly beyond this too. I've been researching Eastman's life and work for a while now, so it's truly a joy to talk about him with Elaine and also the journey of coming across his work. We also get into Elaine's interdisciplinary theatre piece, Sweet Tooth, which looks at the history of the sugar trade through the use of improvisation, text, and movement. We talk about sound and music, representation in classical music, and so much more. I love this conversation, and I really hope you enjoy it. I'd love to know what you're working on at the moment, in the future, this year, how that's been met with the restrictions of, you know, this pandemic. And
of course, yeah. Well, okay, one of the things I can talk about is British Art Show 9, because I'm a British Art Show 9 artist. So it happens every 5 years, and it's a kind of show that it's supposed to represent British art, and it tours to different regional galleries up and down the country, and it's run by Haywood Gallery Touring. I will be showing a work there, which is drawn from Sweet Tooth, which is the piece that I perform. So I'm now in the middle of trying to create an installation, which is interesting for me. I am not known as someone who creates installation works, but I like the challenge of realizing or extending a piece that is a performative piece, in extending it and representing it as a different kind of experience to visitors. It's like another chapter to the work. So that's the thing that I am thinking a lot about at the moment. And there's all the logistic things, which I'm sure you know, because you're a sound artist, the technical issues around creating sound in spaces. And I'd be interested to know how you manage that, because it's a very different process to composing a work and then giving it to someone or performing a work that's been composed for you.
I think in this setting as a composer, I think throughout my very short career as a composer, that's kind of what I've been doing. It's been this almost transactional thing of like, here's the piece, do the thing, thank you, goodbye, next, do the piece. There was one aspect where, just speaking of installations, where I did try and do a kind of sound installation. It was a piece called Sung, based on grief, essentially, the grief of mammals. And it was through the experience of whales who kind of grieve similarly to humans do. And that was really interesting to set it up in that way and trying to engage an audience using solely sound. So I think there was a kind of sacrifice I had to make by adding screens to kind of get the point across and kind of lead the audience through this story of what I'm trying to say.
It's interesting that you should say that you felt that you have to kind of compromise the piece, because you know you have the imagination and the curiosity to just accept sound for what it is, or for it to draw you in and then let your mind's eye work. I know that feeling, because you think, I just want them to engage directly.
It's interesting when you said you're not known as an installation artist. I remember watching a video of you, I think it was Wising Arts, and that to me felt like an installation. And it was just you in the space, and just seeing the audience members, like, of just you walking through the audience, you know, their reaction, their kind of feeling of not knowing what's going to happen next and like where to look, and just looking like you are the installation, like your body. It's kind of like the space doesn't matter.
Do you know, I'd forgotten about that piece. And I mean, I can't claim a complete credit for it, because it was devised by myself and a very good friend who's a long-term collaborator, and his name is Dam Van Huyen. He's Vietnamese-American, and he's a dancer and a choreographer. And we've been working together for 12 years, and he has his own company. And what I've done with Dam is to kind of really explore movement and sound, and how movement manipulates sound, and how to combine those and balance those in the pieces that I have then created. And the solo piece that you saw, a Nude Voice solo one, was a duo. It was the summation of the experience that Dam and I've had working together. He, as an amazing dancer, experiences sound differently. Music plays a different part in the world of dance, full stop. Dam also learned about vocalizing, because of course dancers breathe much higher than trained singers, and it's the opposite. But it's all about, you know, it's the posture, and everything's very erect, everything is really held and contracted, and when they breathe it's very high, it's in the chest, whereas classically trained singer, and that's my training, it's diaphragmatic and it's lower, and it's basically you make yourself look fat, and that's what, and dancers, that's the last thing a dancer is going to do, right? He has learned to improvise vocally, and we decided to create a piece for the Welcome Collection. But so basically this piece, the Nude Voice, was kind of exploring kind of just different ideas we both had about time and motion and voice. And we kept swapping roles. So everything was very contracted and slow, but the vocal improvisation was not in response to the speed of how we're moving or what we're doing. It was a separate entity in itself. And it was because we're both show ponies, and it was a 20-minute piece with egg timers. It was really interesting seeing us in the space, carving up this space with people seated, not knowing what to do. So when I performed it on my own, and Wising was the first time I did so, I wasn't sure that it would work. But I think it does work, actually. And it's a very different experience. There's a lot more responsibility. You can't share it with anyone. And it's, you mentioned me being an installation. Yeah, I guess so. But I just see, because I perform, you know, I just feel it as it's a musical experience rather than a visual arts experience. I can't get my head around these differences, to be honest.
Just hearing the way you speak about dancers, and you're also a movement artist as well. And I feel like, for me anyway, hearing that, it makes me feel like the difference between sound and music, and like dancer and movement. And I wonder like what your take on that is, like movement. Is it kind of similar to that thing of sound and music?
Rebecca, you're asking these deep questions on this side. I think, you know, for me, there are certain things that aren't, it is just a sound, right? You know, we hear sounds all the time around us. You know, if I move, you know, that's a sound. If I shape it, if I repeat it again, or I'm just picking up my mug, and then if I've got, okay, right, when does that become music? When I start to consider shaping that sound and controlling it in a particular way. And that comes out of playing with it and improvising. And then for me, that becomes, it transitions from just an abstract random motion sound to becoming something a bit more musical. I apply meaning behind the sound. And I think it's a head thing. It's difficult when you're, as a sound artist, are you dealing with the substance of sound? Are you shaping it? What is it you're hoping listeners pick up?
I think that's something I've always struggled with. What do I want the listener to think of this, to think of me? Because I feel like myself is always attached to the sound. And as someone that hasn't really had opportunities to perform live or improvise in the way that I'd like to, it's always like pre-recorded things. And I think it comes out in how I record as by improvising. So the improvisation becomes the music. And I think that's partly why I allow certain patterns, like the shape that you say as well, to manifest. So I don't know if it is it even improv if I'm still creating a something recognizable throughout the piece? Or is that something that's still intuitive? I'm not sure.
I think it's hard to separate the intuitive action and the improvisation. And I think there's nothing wrong with structuring that. A structured improvisation. Sometimes I overthink things. And you do need time to process. You need time to think. You need time to question what it is you're doing and why you're doing it. Is that the right approach? Is there another way? There's always another way. I picked up the cup and I put it down, right? And I thought, okay, right, that's one. And then I did it again and I thought, well, actually it could, you know, and then I could start doing something else. And that's the play, that's the improvisatory aspect. And then I go away from it and then I probably come back and think, no, but it could be like this. Okay, I could do it and it's come from a different height. What if I drop it? What if I drop it and it makes that sound and it falls to the floor? Will it smash? Is that what I'm looking for? What is that smash? What am I exploring here? Is it, what do I want to say? And then what you want to say may not always be understood by those who hear it. And that you cannot control. And you cannot second guess the reaction to something. There is no distance. You have to be very careful, I guess, about how you respond to the responses to your work. Do you have kind of mechanisms to help you, to protect you?
I really don't. I feel like I'm just, once that band-aid or plaster has been taken off, it just stays off. And I think because I have such strong, you know, ears to what I'm trying to say sonically, what other people say that might misinterpret it doesn't sink in unless I'm in a setting where it's kind of feedback is necessary. If the setting doesn't allow it, you know, for that kind of response, and I'm just like, well, okay, I'm glad you've got that interpretation. And I think it's also really beautiful to hear other people's interpretations.
I agree. Do you find when someone has experienced what you've done and then have their own reading, which is not, it has nothing to do with the way you feel about the work or the inspiration behind the work or the meaning of the work, do you find you learn more about the work because of that different reading?
Definitely. I think, 100%, especially with this work that I've done on Julius Eastman. And because it's not necessarily me talking about his work, I'm talking about his essence, like what remains of him and how it's kind of, it feels like it's ingrained in me. And it's like a feeling. And then feelings can be interpreted any way, anger, sadness, it can be anything for anyone. So that, I think that, especially with what you just said, I found that quite profound. I did a film on Julius Eastman of that essence. I did kind of like a pamphlet, like a zine that goes along with the film. One of my friends posted it and she was like, oh, it's kind of like a love letter to Julius Eastman. And those words have never been thought or said by me. And then when I actually reflected, I was like, you know what? It kind of is. aside from the kind of the anger around, I feel around, you know, how he's been treated and how little exists on him, and me trying to highlight that, there is also this element of feeling that love and appreciating him as well as just him.
Did you attend the Julius Eastman Retrospective Festival that the London Contemporary Music Festival did in 2016?
I did.
Oh, that was my first experience of the festival as a performer. Mm. I'd known Julius Eastman's work when I was a student 1,000 years ago. The Unjust Malaise CD came out. A friend had told me about Julius Eastman at college. At that time, I mean, black composers, very few. Hardly any. I mean, outside of jazz, in terms of classical music, it wasn't talked about at music college, let's put it that way. Julius Eastman's name came up and I've got the album, the CD. I was really excited to hear it, really excited to say, I put this on and I got in touch with Mary Jane Leach. She wrote back and Mary Jane and I had been corresponding off and on for about 10 years. I remember listening to Stay On It first and thinking, feeling really disappointed. I'm embarrassed to say that. I don't know what I was expecting musically. I don't know. And I now realise it was down to the performance. And I'm not saying they did a bad job, but they didn't do justice to the music. And that's not because they can't play, but it was more of an energy. It's just something was lacking for me. So we move on a number of years, 2016, then Apartment House asked me to do it. I'm like, yeah. So I get the score and I'm like, the score's based, it's a transcription of that performance that's used on the album.
Yeah.
So it's very open, you know, it's very sketchy. And I was singing it and kind of preparing and I thought, there's something not right. It's just, this doesn't feel right to me. This is not Eastman. I did not know that it was Julius Eastman on the 8 songs for a Mad King performance, which is Peter Maxwell Davies. And it's his performance, that recording, which is like the go-to recording. But I hadn't put the two together. I didn't know he was responsible for that. And neither did I know that he wasn't on the fringes of the contemporary new music scene. He was very much a part of it. You can't really record Peter Maxwell Davies and not be part of the scene. And I'm like, well, how come his name was not known?
Exactly.
Was unknown or kind of forgotten. He sang in Meredith Monk's ensemble. We all know who Meredith Monk is.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So it's this, but it's not just Julius Eastman. It's happened to so many people. So many. So in preparing for the performance, I just thought I'm just going to Google a bit and see what could come up. And CCA, the Centre for Contemporary Art in Glasgow, was the base for a lot of experimental performance art and contemporary music. And Eastman's ensemble did a European tour in the early 70s, and there's footage of him performing. And I remember when I came across that, and I'm saying this is days before I was due to perform it at the festival, yes, my instincts were right. This is how you do it. It needs that level of wildness.
Yeah.
Which you can't hear on the CD. You just need to throw caution to the winds.
Mm.
And you really need to just, if you don't do that with a piece, it doesn't make sense when we all lock in and play that refrain or that motif. That's the staying on it. That is the thing that steers you through. And you have to ask yourself, what does that mean? Stay on it. What does it mean? How, you know, if I'm going to sing it this way, I'll sing it, then what am I trying to say? And for the ensemble, it's terrifying if you're not used to improvising. Most classically trained musicians don't improvise.
And what was that like?
In my head, I just remember saying to him, look, just we know what the cues are. We knew who was cueing what. He said, in between that, when you're improvising, just have fun. Don't pull out of your bag of all the best contemporary extended techniques I've ever learned, right? If you need to do that, then use it as a springboard onto other things. You know, you have to, in order to be able to feel, to enjoy improvising, you do need to listen. Because someone will play something that will inspire you, and you might just latch onto that, and then you just not go on to somewhere else. But don't be afraid. And there's no wrong here. The only wrong thing you can do is not listen, because that means you're off on one. You're not going to stay on it. We need you to stay
exactly,
on it.
Yeah.
You know, there are moments when you're in something, you think, oh man, this is a car crash. But also, that's what Eastman wants. There are moments where it just has this mangled wreck. And you're like, oh, what's going on? No.
Yes.
And I remember there were moments where I was like, oh, stop.
Exactly. But you're right. That's exactly what Eastman wants. Like,
he
in
wants
a lot
that.
Of his music, I think the scores that exist of him, like the sketches that he made himself, perhaps they were deliberately done in that way to open up something that doesn't necessarily live in traditional scoring methods or notation.
I completely agree with you. And he was trying, he was experimenting, and he wanted to kind of blow up this sort of fixed, rigid way, whilst respecting the canon, because he knew it. He demands that you do what is on the score, and he asks you to trust the process. Mm. And if you're unwilling to trust that process, you cannot perform the work. Right. It's as simple as that. Because you go there to your own peril if you think you can just do whatever you like, because you'll be spat out at the end wondering what happened.
I love how Apartment House are still championing his work. I always see on social media this, you know, he's always there. I love that they've kept that going. It's wonderful. And how did your relationship start with Apartment House?
Well, Anton, who runs it, and I really admire the way they program. It's very democratic. Basically, the way it works is if he asks you to do something in Apartment House, you get an invitation, you know, you say, hey, I've got this project, would you like to do it? And then you say yes, and then therefore you are a member of Apartment House. That's what happened with the Eastman. I've performed with them a number of times. And it's funny, because you work with certain people and you get on with them, and then you create projects which allow you to work together again if they're the right people. You know, it's kind of, you build a family.
I was thinking that with just how Apartment House, even just like if you've worked with them, that you remain a part of Apartment House. I love that you can just, that community aspect of it.
I think that's so important.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be even more important as we go into 2021, where everyone's going to be desperate to have work and to stay working and stay creative, that we remember our family, you know, kind of creative family as well. I'm going to say, extend that net, cast it further, because that includes people who are not involved in the arts as well. You know, it's a more of a mindset. It's more of kind of kindred spirits, people who hold similar ideas and they want to help to improve society with what they're doing, and you work together. I think that's so important, because those things have been undermined by political structures, and
sure,
some communities always had this, where they looked out for each other anyway. And I think some communities surprised themselves, some people surprised themselves about what they have learnt about their neighbours, or that they can be more giving. And I think from an artistic point of view, the artistic community needs to dig deep with that. I think we're all going to be pitted against each other, because we're all so desperate to get working again.
Yeah. Towards the end of my degree, I actually got more work than I'd ever gotten.
Why was that? What happened?
I feel like a lot of people around me had time to have ideas. And of course, like, funding opportunities opened up because of the crisis. And there was just more time to reach out to people. So I think maybe just the time just allowed maybe my name to come up more. This year, I've just worked on so many different types of projects. is this going to stop when things go back to go back to normal? Like,
just see everything as building, because we don't know. This year was building for next year and the year beyond that. We're doing the stuff now, but what about 2021? What about 2022?
Right.
You know, and my friend and I, we used to laugh about whether or not we got a commission. Well, that really ever happened. But it's when you get your first commission, that is for 2 years' time, then you know you're on the right road. Yes.
Where were you at in your career when you got that commission?
Okay. In 2010, I used to work with composers, as in I used to promote composers, and I worked for a classical music publishing house, an Italian one called Ricordi. There was a shift in my employment status, mm-hmm. and I was faced with, are you going to do this singing thing forever, or are you going to still mess around and try and do both? So I chose to throw everything into being a full-time musician. So in 2010, I was offered a residency in Venice for 3 months. So I was involved in a Belgian project run by Music Theatre Transparent, and it was called Century Songs. And basically they brought together different kinds of vocalists for a 2-year project where we would meet for a week, 4 times a year, and devise a piece guided by David Moss, who is an American vocalist and percussionist who lives in Berlin, and Wouter van Looy, who directed us. And we would present the outcome of that week of research and play and stuff at a festival. So I really enjoyed that, because that kind of helped me to kind of really cement what I wanted to do. And also I'm singing and in an environment which was unfamiliar to me. I don't know that scene outside of the UK, because I was improvising a little bit and working with some free improv musicians, amazing musicians. I needed to extend my experience. Music Theatre Transparent had an association with a foundation in Venice. And so I was offered this residency, and that's a massive turning point. But it was great because I could research things, and I invited a friend, David Toop, who I'd worked with on his piece, Star-Shaped Biscuit. And I asked David to create a piece with me in mind, and he created Of Leonardo da Vinci, which used the diaries of Leonardo da Vinci and a sound piece by David. Mm. And I improvised the vocal part using this text. We kind of did a sharing in 2010, and I really wanted to develop the piece further. And Dom had come back from Hong Kong, and I said, look, I've got this piece, really want to present it somewhere. Shall we just have a go at just playing? I then, because I was in publishing, I still had quite a lot of email addresses of festival contacts. And I was lucky, and I think it had to do with timings. Luck plays a massive, you make your own luck, right? So, yeah. And you have to be very patient.
Yeah, it's not always as spontaneous.
No, don't believe the films. It is hard to pursue a creative, artistic career, lifestyle, a career, to follow that in your life. It is a challenge to do that if you're not coming from a background where that's kind of valued. But I basically wrote to a colleague at a festival in Oslo. I wrote to loads of festivals. I wrote to loads of, hey, I got this piece. I've done this work with Dave Toop. Would you be interested in taking it? We need to finish it. And so to our astonishment, and this is 2015, 5 years after starting that piece, we got a response. And they said, yeah, the festival's in September. Now, you know, I got that email in June. It's a 50-minute piece. So we had to work really hard. And that piece, I've performed it about 5 times. I really enjoy it. And it was a very important piece in terms of bringing together the ideas that we had been researching about movement and improvisation. I mean, I presented that, and then Sound and Music have supported me with Industrializing Intimacy. Then 2017, the Sweet Tooth. Sweet Tooth, I was researching for 5 years.
I wanted to get into that, actually. Of course, the research and time that went into that. But also how you approach accessing those stories using your voice and using your body. Was there anything that was different about how you normally...
Each work is unique and requires different kind of access in terms of, because of what the piece is about. With Sweet Tooth, I mean, it's such a big subject. Someone who I respect enormously, they asked me, what right did I have to tackle this, to present it in a kind of artistically creative way, musical way? My answer was because nobody seems to know about this period and why things are the way they are in the UK. And the things that happened in the past, how they impact on our present, that is something that we need to face up to and acknowledge. So that helped me to find ways to access the movement. First of all, there are the facts. And I got in touch with Krista Petley, someone who studied that period and may help me access other kind of books, other areas of research, because it's a massive topic. And I wanted to really focus on the UK and the Caribbean, because at school, it was more about what happened in the States. Krista was the historical consultant, and it was really helpful to have him on board, because if you're not part of academia, you can't really access certain books, or you just don't know it's there, do you? And it was useful because also for him, because, you know, historians deal with the dry facts. They're passionate about it, but it's very distant, whereas we pull this information and we process it and then we chuck it out in another way, you know, we communicate it another way. And I think he was completely startled by what I did with his research for his PhD, which was on Simon Taylor, who was a very successful and a horrible person, but a successful plantation owner in Jamaica, and his diaries. And I took an extract from his diaries and use that towards the end of Sweet Tooth. And Krista was he was adamant, said, I don't want this to memorialize people like Simon Taylor. I said, don't worry, that's not what this piece is about. But it was the sound, and coming back to you as a sound artist, as well as being a composer, it was the sound of that acted as triggers. You know, and so I had to try, Krista was explaining about the mechanisms and the kind of equipment used, and I'm reading accounts of hands being chopped off or hands or limbs being mangled as the cane is being ground, and this thing that just needs to keep going at the cost of human lives. I'm trying to imagine those sounds and how they can only do that by dehumanizing someone. And so that's why the actions in the mill section of Sweet Tooth, we've got the canes, that I wanted us to not only work with it musically, but at some point we become the machine, and then we break out, and then there's the kind of joyful aspects of actually singing and dancing. And for me, that's resistance, because all of that is part of the code and the message of, you know, revolt. And so there is all these things that I really wanted to access and use, but they're all based on facts. And it was hard. It was really hard. And it's mentally hard, and it's physically hard, and it's emotionally hard. And it's a difficult piece, I think, for people to sit through.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Obviously, I'm hearing about the process for the first time, but I've seen it on online. I didn't see it live. But there was that element of it being so difficult to watch because it was so personal to me, because it is something that still runs through my own history and is still affecting me today. And so many people around me, of course. But for you as well, performing this and even like the lead up to performing it and going home after performing this piece, it to me doesn't feel like something you'd be like, oh, cool, I'm just going to leave that on the stage and go home. Like,
it's someone asked me the same question not that long ago. You have to develop ways. That's why I asked you earlier in our conversation about mechanisms for coping. If you don't develop a way for yourself, it can be very difficult. It can actually hinder future performances of the same work. It can prevent you from accessing that, what you need to access to present it. It never leaves me, but it's just to step back. Because when we're performing it, we are so in it. Sylvia Hallett, Jason Yard, Mark Sanders. I mean, they're amazing artists in their own right. And it is built around their capabilities as well. I created it with them. That was the last piece we performed together in March this year.
Wow.
At Borealis Festival in Bergen. And performed it on the 8th of March. That was a really powerful performance. I don't know why, but at the end of it, because it's a strange piece, you can't really just, people do applaud, but they're not applauding because, you know, they've just been through Hamilton or something. It's not that kind of piece.
No.
I just think people need to release something, they need to release, because the way I've, and I hope I hope we get a chance to perform it again, and I hope you get a chance to see it live, experience it live, because there is something that I do in the way that it's staged, and because of social distancing, I don't know if I could do it that way again.
Right.
But it's important for me that the audience experience it in a particular way.
Yeah.
That's why they're as exhausted as I am at the end of it. You know, they don't even realise it.
The audience seeing this piece, or even saying like witnessing this piece, is they're clapping, like you said, because it's the only way they're allowed to express.
Yeah.
That's like appropriate to express their emotion. How I felt after watching it was I did cry. I was crying. You know, I think for some people, you know, depending on the audience, it's like they're either like just oblivious to this history, denying the history, or a part of that history and like trying to get by, you know. Sitting down and doing the research felt way too painful. I think this was the perfect way to acknowledge this part of history, something that I wasn't that clued up on as well. I felt it just gave me more agency to cry about it. And of course there was anger, and of course there are other emotions, but to express my sadness, I felt like this was the perfect container to do that. And I think that's why whoever's watching it must feel that way as well, because we all know this existed. We all know it existed in this country.
Yeah.
Slavery is something that Britain has a lot of responsibility for the emotion of what people feel, you know, white audience members that have seen this. I'm always interested to see what are they thinking on their way home?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because one of the things that I thought about when I was preparing, I mean, first of all, I wanted the right musicians involved in this project. People I know who are not going to shy away. It would have been easier, I think, to have had an all-black cast. In a lot of ways, that would have been a more powerful statement, but it's a more obvious statement.
Yeah.
By having Sylvia, who is not black, Sylvia is white, she's a brilliant musician, she's also very politically aware and engaged, but she also had to go through the process.
Yeah.
Because she's English, and that was why I needed to have someone who wasn't black in this. The majority of my audiences are white, because I think as black artists working not in mainstream music, we have to accept and be aware that the majority of our audiences will be white, and for most black people are not interested. It's just not, that's not their thing. And that's fine. That is absolutely fine. There are other creative fields that are of interest to our community. Yeah. If it's not kind of left field contemporary music or right. The classical music, straight up classical music, well, that's the way it is, you know? And that's, I mean, maybe that will change over the years, but if it doesn't, then that's all cool. But when I presented Sweet Tooth, it's what I've noticed that afterwards people have engaged in very frank, deep conversations, not with me, but with each other, with the person next to them who was probably a stranger. You kind of need to just talk to someone who was there as a fellow traveller.
Since Sweet Tooth, perhaps the people expect you to make more work similar. Like, and I'm thinking in the context of, you know, over the summer of George Floyd being murdered, and do you think people were kind of lying in wait, like, oh, Elaine, are you you know what I mean?
Yeah, I only put out political work. It's all about identity. It's the only way that I can talk about the things that I feel political about, you know. I can find my voice speaks through the work, and I have said I would really like to be in a comedy, or, you know, because I think most people think I spend all my time going, you know it's like, yeah, some kind of Greek tragedy, and I like to laugh, you know, just kind of have joy. But I also, I'm not really a light entertainment kind of presenter, but I think those expectations are there. So when the tragic events around George Floyd, and, you know, that has been repeated since,
yeah,
but we haven't all gone out marching since. So what's happened? Is it not important anymore? Do you see what I mean? It's like that's why these our works kind of need to remind people of it's a continuous thing, you know. The change doesn't happen overnight. You have to keep fighting. Look at Angela Davis, she's in her 70s, and she's alive to see what happened in the summer and what's still going on.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? It's like, but she hasn't given up. So I use the work as reminders to myself and maybe to those who want to experience it. Do you know Iain Bailey?
I do, yes, I do.
Right, so, and she had an exhibition last year at the Cubit Gallery, and she invited different artists to respond to the exhibition. And I performed Amazing Grace, and it's something that I performed, well, I premiered it there, and then sang it again on the night of the first lockdown at Cafe Oto when they were live streaming. And then I have, because I'm working with movement still, I kind of slowly kind of just melt into the ground whilst singing this. But Amazing Grace, if you know the history behind the yeah. song. It, you know, it's such a, well, hymn, I should say. Mm. It's so well known. It's a favourite, you know, it's one of my mother's favourite hymns. But it's about a song of transformation and, a, you know, someone woke up to what they were doing. But also it's what they were doing was so wrong. There was a reason why I mentioned it, because it was interesting singing it in front of a small group of people at the Cubit Gallery. It was no less powerful doing it for that. Yeah, people, it always amazes me that audiences trust what I'm doing and stick with it. Actually, that's very generous of them.
Yeah,
it's quite short. It's 10 minutes. And it felt different presenting it at Cafe Otto on the first lockdown. So it was that night when Boris Johnson said,
yeah.
right, stay home. And I felt as a performer, a responsibility to try and present the work, present it with a real kind of honesty and directness, because none of us knew when we might perform again.
You seem to be choose your moments of having these very important moments of your performances. You know, the Sweet Tooth, the last show, you know, the night of lockdown.
It's not me. It's not me. All I'm going to say are the forces at play here. I've just had the amazing grace. It was selected to be part of the Sky TV takeover by Marina Abramovic. She did 6.5 hour performance arts.
Yeah,
yeah. Night.
Yeah.
And so I performed Amazing Grace then. And it felt, it. I was just thinking about each time I presented it, it can stand the treatment that I'm giving it, because it's actually a very well written hymn. Mm. Because the way I approach it with its history. It's like I can't watch a Jane Austen film, a Jane Austen dramatisation, without thinking about the people of colour that live in the UK at that time. You know, because she does mention a guy who's come back from the West Indies, and an Englishman who's in the West Indies is only there for a reason. And I'm like, Jane! I just stopped there, Jane! There's an amazing dramatisation of Oliver Twist. And it's David Lean, so it's old. And there's a scene, I'll never forget it. I remember seeing it when I was a lot younger and watching it. And in the tavern, David Lean, the director, there's loads of people, and they're black people in the pub. And I thought, yes, yeah. That's what you do.
Yeah.
That's what you do, because it's history, it's fact. You clock it, you think, what are they doing there? Why are they just, yes.
This is, I feel like myself included, a lot of black people do have that automatic like switch that's just like looking for another.
It is funny what you're saying that, because I felt that way working in classical music publishing, because yeah. you know, you go to concerts and you and then I was talking to my friend, the amazing composer Hannah Kendall, yeah. who, if you don't know her work, check her out. Her opera was presented at the Opera House and streamed a couple of months ago. She worked in classical music PR, and it was really, we were having a laugh about this not that long ago. I remember I remember spotting her in the festival hall, and I've got an orchestral concert. I'm like, who's that? Yes. And then you go to some kind of meeting where it's all kind of arts managers or arts.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, there she is again. And she said, Elaine, I just... And then she said, oh my goodness, now I know. I was like, what do you mean? She said, well, for years, I go to these parties and composers would come up to me and say, you work in publishing, right?
Oh,
okay. It's just like, no. I would say, hey, it's Elaine, right?
Oh, and no. Like,
and the thing is, we don't even look alike.
That's but it.
Was, I guess if there are only two black women who are not on stage performing and working in classical music, then probably will get mixed up. This year has really, the events of this year has kind of forced the hand of institutions that probably wouldn't have bothered to make changes, and they can't get away with it now. I would hope that it's coming from a genuine place, even if their hands have been forced, that they realise we've been too slow on this uptake. Percentage of the black population in the UK is still small. Mm. We can't expect to have half the orchestra represent. We just can't, because and also education is not allowing that. So the things that you're doing, the things that I'm trying to do, and our fellow travellers, that's how we can make those changes. But I may not see it in the way that I would like to see it in my lifetime, because it takes a long time.
It does. And it's like, God, it takes this moment in history where we're all collectively going through something, and to have the time to be tuned into something.
Well, they can't get away with not knowing or feigning ignorance now, you know. And so, you know, for example, George Lewis, who very generously asked me to co-curate the London Sinfonietta's concert, Yet Unheard, was music by black composers.
Yeah.
That is a step forward. You know, it can't be a one-off. It has to be done this way until we get to a stage where it doesn't matter the race of the composer. What matters is how good the work is. Do you know what I mean? Or the gender, because the same thing could be said about, you know, all women concerts and, you know, but we have to program in this way until it's not, we don't have to.
Yeah, because I still think it, like, as great as it is for black composers and black sound and musicians to have opportunities, more opportunities than before, to be in these spaces, there is still something kind of uncomfortable about being put there because you're black and it ending there. I think, it, like you said, to come to get to a space where it's not like, there's a black composer in the Royal Albert Hall, or like, there's a, you know, this black woman conducting this awkward, like, the gasp, like, when the kind of hysteria around that, like, that is just a step to another step, which will be far more just safer. It would just feel like, you know, progress has been made, where we stop gasping that these people exist because history hasn't allowed it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, we also must be patient with ourselves and not feel that we have to be representative, we speaking for everyone, because you can't. You can only speak for yourself, and you represent yourself. I think there is a tendency to expect that from us. You know, if you're interviewed, if you're questioned about anything, that you then, what you say represents every other black person, and you, but we're all different, and we all have different experiences, and we all think differently. And I might disagree with you, Rebecca. That doesn't mean you're wrong and I'm right, or I'm right and you're wrong. I think also changes behind the scenes in terms of program, those who are decision makers, that needs to be more representative as well, as and also in terms of class, because in the UK that's a massive thing. It needs to change, because you can't empathize with people unless you know, unless you have some kind of understanding of of their life experience. You just can't.
Definitely.
But change is happening. Tokes Dada is head of classical music at the South Bank Centre. Yes. Oh, he's great. I mean, it's a massive challenge. But I think he will do good things. He understands the repertoire. He understands orchestras. And you have to know, whatever you do, Rebecca, whatever area you're working in, you have to know. You can't afford not to know. We're not being judged equally. You have high standards and you keep them high. And you have to just keep keep them high, you just have to keep working and keep positive. And also, I think, be kind to yourself as well. And that and it's, otherwise you can't work, you can't create, you can't do anything. And also just kind of know who your allies are. Some don't look like you, some don't come from the same backgrounds as you, and some, you know, but they are allies. And I think that's really important as well, because this kind of fight for change and it can't be done on its own. We can't do it on our own.
Elaine, thank you. You were an inspiration to me before this conversation, and more so now. So I'm just so grateful to have had this conversation with you. Thank you for everything.
Thank you for reaching out.
And that was my conversation with Elaine Michener for this episode of Inspired on the Barbican podcast, Nothing Concrete. Next week, we have Barbican Young Film Programmer alumni, writer and journalist Rogan Graham, who speaks to actor Susan Wacoma about process, activism and inspiration. Please do stay tuned for more inspiring conversations by subscribing to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify or wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good one. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.